Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host Robert Kirkwood, and today is part two of my chat with Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones, aka The Map Men, about their book This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters. Plus, we'll find some brand new books in the RNIB library.
All that and more on today's Read On, the audiobook show.
Previously on Read On.
Maps, 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 maps. The sausage of doom. Maps, maps, maps. Brilliant. Maps.
And now the conclusion. This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters, is the debut book from the Map Men, Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones. In a show that many people are calling last week's episode of Read On, we chatted about accents, about breaking the fourth wall, and about turning a very visual book into an audiobook. This week we'll chat about accessibility, made-up mountains, an audiobook coincidence, and we'll even have a play with a tactile map from RNIB. But first, let's hear from the book. This Way Up is narrated by Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones.
While Britain can pride itself on a lot of things, very polite drivers, the world's most robust plug sockets, and an unparalleled variety of crisp flavours, one thing it's never been terribly good at is splitting itself up into bits. For comparison, let's have a look at France just next door. France is divided neatly into 13 regions, which are further subdivided into 96 departments.
Footnote, technically 18 regions and 101 departments if you count the overseas territories.
These play a pivotal and visible role in many aspects of French life, from local government to postal addresses to car number plates, with all the systems working consistently and harmoniously. The effect of this is that every French person knows where they are and which of their neighbours they band with for various regional identity purposes. Put simply, every French person knows their place. But ask a Brit what part of the country they're in, and there are 100 different ways they could answer your question. There are dozens of different systems the UK uses to divide itself, each for a different purpose and each using a different map, with borders that tangle in and out of each other like headphone cables.
This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters, in audio as narrated by Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones. And I asked the Map Men if it was important that the book was now accessible for all.
Hugely, yeah, because I want this to be accessible for everybody who wants to enjoy it. And there are so many reasons to want to consume your book through audio rather than on a printed page. And we always think about accessibility when it comes to our YouTube videos as well. So for deaf people, we pay a lot of attention to making sure that there are always captions. And we always make sure if we're putting something on Twitter that we make sure the alt descriptions are there, because really this stuff is for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important to us. You know, I think when you're putting out content into the world, you're doing that because you're imagining people consuming it, and you don't want there, obviously, to be a barrier to anybody being able to do that. So, yeah, certainly the audio book process, we were incredibly mindful of that as we spent about a week, I think, going through the book document and making small amends. Obviously, we wanted to be as absolutely true to what we had written as possible, but also trying to make it accessible. That was probably 5 days' work, wasn't it, Jay? Just going, that's not going to be quite clear enough. That won't make sense, you know, if you can't see it.
Yeah, so I think it was absolutely worth it. And by doing that, we actually managed to make some changes where, you know, not just for accessibility, but just for general sense. We go, you know what, let's change this overall. Like, whether or not it's for the audio version, we found an improvement. So that's another reason why it's always good to make sure that the stuff you make is accessible from all angles, because it just makes it a better experience for everybody.
Now, during the recording, were you always in the same room, and how often did you make each other laugh?
We were always in the same room.
We were in the same room. We were sat like 2 meters away from each other. It was 4 days' work recording the audiobook. As for making each other laugh, so Mark and I did laugh at each other's jokes during the writing stage, But by the time we came to recording the audiobook, we were both very, very familiar with the chapters. So, you know, we're reading these things that did make us laugh a lot many months earlier. But then, you know, when the job comes of just reading it out loud, it's sort of, well, we've already heard it all before. I think one thing that I did find amusing was listening to Mark do the voices. There's one bit, there was a chapter towards the end where we have a phone call between Chief Judah of the Marshall Islands and President Harry Truman. And we hadn't actually played out the dialogue back and forth between us during the writing stage. And that was more fun than I expected, because that's one of the only parts of the whole book where we're talking over each other. And we actually sort of, it sounds slightly improvised, but it wasn't. It was very tightly scripted. And I did enjoy that bit.
Oh, hang on a minute. You know what? Actually, there is something that I think about. It literally just occurred to me. It's a small favour, but my sole concern is world peace, so I know you'll be in. We need to explode a little bit of ordnance somewhere.
I see. Well, I guess America is pretty big, so Oklahoma, Minnesota.
Yeah. Interesting. I suppose, yeah, no, that is one thought. And I'll bear that in mind. Thanks for that. Yes. But actually,
You've already decided, haven't you?
There's a massive fleet on its way as we speak, yeah.
If you need to test a bit of TNT somewhere, it's not like I can say no, is it? We're not talking another Hiroshima. President? Surely you don't
mean... OK, well, nice talking. Catch up later. Bye! Boo!
I remember it being fun all around, though. I mean, I think we really... It was really enjoyable just to go through and read the book slowly and deliberately as well, because I think you get to a stage with a manuscript that we were working from where you're sort of like, yeah, I know this. You're sort of, you're almost like rushing through it to try and find a problem or make a change or whatever it might be. And actually to slowly and deliberately go through it and read out the footnotes and do that kind of thing, it was definitely fun. I'm not sure you ever quite made me laugh, Jay, but, you know, I'm still waiting.
How many times did you say the word park life?
Many, many, many times. So there's a footnote in the book early on. It's during the chapter about the Situationists. And I can't remember the exact sentence. It says, Guy Debord was fond of making extremely wild statements with long, complicated words such as this. And then the sentence reminds me so much of the song Park Life. I couldn't resist putting in a footnote that says, Park Life!
However, but of course... You were not
what I just did was not allowed in the audiobook. You're not allowed to sing a copyrighted tune. And so the audio engineer that was in there, he says, like, yeah, you're not allowed to sing Park Life. So I tried it again, a bit less tunefully. Park Life. And he's like, no, that's still too close. Like, you cannot make it sound like you were trying to sing. You have no option but to just read Park Life calmly. I was like, but that makes no sense. That's weird. Like,
wait, is that what we did in the end? How did it sound in the end?
We eventually just said footnote. So another decision we made was that every footnote has to come after the word
labeled.
Actually saying footnote every time, which I was a bit reluctant to do at first, but I realized after a while, actually, that's quite funny. That makes it sound more like a book. And so it means that Mark says this ridiculously long sentence, and then I say footnote, park life, which, you know, if you get the reference, it's weird.
Use your imagination.
If you don't get the reference, yeah. It's really weird.
Yeah, that singing copyright thing would extend to the riffs from U2's Streets With No Name.
That's exactly right.
Exactly, yeah. And SpongeBob SquarePants as well. Like, we weren't allowed to sing the theme from SpongeBob SquarePants. We had to recite.
But that was easier because that was lyrics, right? Whereas with the U2 quote at the beginning of the chapter, the map that was blank, was it? You just going, ooh.
Oh, it was Mark, it was your turn. You were going,
oh. Oh, it was me. I forgot.
Bono from U2. And the thing is, that joke is weird enough when you're allowed to sing it, because that's the wrong song. We're expecting Where the Streets Have No Name, but that's from a different U2 song. I'm reminded of, there was an audiobook I was listening to. It was Limmy's Daft Wee Stories, and there's a bit where he's supposed to be singing Happy Birthday to You, and he's singing it slightly off key. And I was thinking when I was listening to that, like, is that Brian's singing voice, or was he not allowed to actually sing Happy Birthday to You? You might know the answer, Robert.
Yeah, well, I did produce and edit that book, and there were a lot of discussions in the background about, there is a chapter that's printed upside down, so if you're reading the physical print book, it looks really suspicious if you're on the bus or the train and you're reading this book upside down. So we did have to step back and say, okay, in the print book, this is this. And, you know, there were things that we had to explain to the audio audience.
A very similar thing happened to us, where at the end of chapter 11, the one we were talking about, where the streets have no name, we posit a theory towards the end of the chapter that says it's not impossible that maybe in 50 years' time, people will not be using human pronounceable street names anymore. And then it says, if we're wrong, then write us a letter to tell us we were wrong and send it to like that. Now, in the print version, that is a bunch of symbols and punctuation and little hash marks and stuff. It's completely unpronounceable. And I was reading at that point of the book, and so I made that noise. And then Mark interrupted, and he says, X percent greater than, less than, punctuation, hash. And he was reading one by one all of the punctuation marks, making me laugh because I didn't know he was going to do it. And then the chapter ends with a genuinely improvised moment where I say, yeah, to be fair, that is exactly what it says in the print version. And Alex, our producer, he left it in.
And Alex makes an appearance throughout the book.
No, the appearance comes from our real editor, Joel. So Joel is our editor. And there were a couple of footnotes in the book that are supposed to be written by our editor, like he's disagreeing with us or he's, you know, warning us about something.
Marking our homework.
And when it came to, planning the audiobook, we thought, oh, you know what? It would actually be really funny if we got the real Joel to come down to the studio and record. He only had four lines, but we asked him anyway, and he was delighted. And I think it's probably the first time one of his authors has actually asked him to be in the audiobook. So he came all that way. It took him about 5 minutes.
He nailed it too.
He did a great job. Yeah, he absolutely did. And, you know, you cannot, I think there's no actor in the world that could properly nail a performance by someone who genuinely doesn't do this sort of thing normally. And that's, you know, you can hear the joy in his voice that he's allowed near the microphone. Unless you're on a boat, a plane, or a picnic, chances are you're reading this on a street with a name right now. Some examples of street names include Beverly Gardens, Vernon Drive, Baker Street, East Scotland Street Lane, Craix Road, and Bouarc Avenue.
Footnote. In the first draft of this chapter, this section went on for 9 pages. After a lot of back and forth with our editor, we agreed these examples were sufficient.
This is a more recent phenomenon than you might expect. Giving streets labels and insisting we all use the same ones and spell them the same way only became necessary when the concept of having post delivered to your door came along, which in England was in the 18th century. Before then, people collected their post from designated collection points such as inns or coffee houses. But once all streets had names, the system became invaluable, and they became a taken-for-granted part of everyday life. In a lot of cases, the name can provide useful information about the street. For example, the self-explanatory Station Road tells you that the road contains, or contained, a railway station. Sometimes it tells you where you'll end up if you follow it all the way to the end. Uxbridge Road, for example, is a name used by high streets all over West London because they all form part of the old road that leads to Uxbridge. Nowadays, if you're driving, you'd take the A40, but the name's still useful if you want to orient yourself, or imagine how bad the traffic must have been before they built the A40. Sometimes, a street name can give you a quick history lesson on the activity that used to take place there. The unusually named Poultry in the City of London, which today is a skyscraper-lined thoroughfare in the financial district, used to be the best place to buy chickens in medieval times. See also nearby Bread Street, Bread, Milk Street, Milk, and Grape Lane. Not grapes. Don't Google it.
From being the man behind the glass years ago, I'm glad Alex got a shout out, though. It's very rare your engineer gets a mention in the book.
Well, he was absolutely brilliant. I mean, a shout out was not enough for Alex, who was... He was indispensable, actually, not only because he was doing a job that we couldn't do. He was doing the sound engineering on it. But he had an incredible knowledge and, like, you know, a sort of, it put us to shame. He sort of knew so much about the stories we were telling, and just like he was sort of live fact checking as we went through the audiobook. And he was like,
I'm sure you're right about that one, guys.
We're just going to have to, we'd have to make notes for the real copy
and
of the thing.
It would be impressive enough if Alex's job was just to sit and listen and fact check and, you know, let us know when our performance is going well or badly or whatever. But he's doing this while clicking and making edits and making sure that the audio is balanced and that, you know, whenever there's a fluff, and we fluff a lot, he has to then reset the playhead and start again. And he's doing all of that whilst listening for the sense of things. And then, like, you know, we'll come up to a word that we never did work out how to pronounce. And he'll say, don't worry, lads, I've Googled it for you. Here it is. So, yeah, Alex was brilliant.
And giving much needed confidence boosts to people trying out accents. He was an absolute all rounder and superb.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover of This Way Up?
We've got two circles, one diagonally top left, the other diagonal bottom right. And they are the two polar hemispheres, if you like. So the top left shows the Antarctic hemisphere from the bottom in circle form, and the bottom right circle is a sort of oldie looking map of the Arctic hemisphere, just shown with the North Pole at the centre of that circle. And they are touching, those two circles, so they're very large, and they're a very nice light blue colour, and the rest of the book, the kind of the other two corners, if you like, are sort of a bright orange. We were quite keen that there are a lot of map books. Well, there are a lot of map books, full stop. And most of them tend to go for that sort of tea-stained, oldie, you know, treasure map almost, you know, or maritime map look, a sort of 16th century old parchment feel to it. And we were really
sort
keen
that
it didn't
says,
just...
Here be dragons.
Yeah, we didn't want it to feel like it was just going to be just a history book, because there are contemporary stories in it as well. And also, you know, what Jay and I do on YouTube, we're on the entertainment slash comedy side of things. So we wanted to show that with these bright colours. So hence the orange and light blue colours. And then we've got the word this sort of slightly raised and slightly shiny along the bottom of the Antarctic circle. And then way up is sort of going around the circumference of the other circle. Underneath it. And then we've stuck the little Mapmen logo at the top. Oh, yes, it says This Way Up. And obviously when maps go wrong and why it matters. But on the P of up, This Way Up, the line of the P extends all the way down to the corner of the book. And it sort of wraps around the back of the book and comes back over the top corner and points down to the pole at Antarctica. So it's got this sort of wraparound diagonal black arrow, which we spent far too long.
I think that's the most
important
detail is talking. That it says This Way Up and the arrow points down.
Yeah. And we're really fussy about our arrows, aren't we? We had to spend a lot of back and forth with the design team saying it's not quite the right arrow. We'd like a slightly thicker head to the arrow
normally,
and a slightly...
Yeah, on YouTube, the majority of the graphics we do ourselves. But for this book, they just said to us, you write the words and we're going to do everything else. Like, we're in charge of the look of the cover, the marketing and so on. So we didn't get to design the cover ourselves, but we got to... We saw different versions and we gave our feedback and we said, oh, we like this and we don't like that so much.
We are talking from RNIB, and I hope I've maybe educated you slightly, both by sending you a tactile map. Now, how was it actually experiencing that atlas through your fingertips?
It was incredible. I mean, it's a... I didn't know that sort of map existed. The closest I've experienced to that was in... It was none other than Glasgow. There's a tactile map of the city centre of Glasgow where you can run your fingers over it so that you can sort of feel the overall shape of the city and where the tall buildings are. But it never occurred to me that you could actually get like a great big paper version of a tactile map of maps of the world. So the one that you sent me, thank you very much for sending it, by the way. I had a feel of it. So the first thing I did was to glance at it. And you know, I could see the map because I can see where it's raised and it looked very familiar. And I thought to myself, I'm going to give myself the challenge. I'm going to turn over the next page. I'm not going to look at it. I'm just going to feel. And can I, since I'm familiar with the world map, can I work out where I'm feeding a map of? And it was impossible. I had such little experience of feeding my way around a piece of paper that it's a skill I just don't have. But it was incredible to think that this is a way of understanding the world. And it's a very different way of taking it in, because you get a great sensation for how bumpy a coastline is from actually feeling the bumps themselves.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you have to, there's a different cartographic skill there as well, isn't it? I mean, obviously you have to think about how much information you're putting on that map so that it remains clear. And also obviously the different ways in which you're going to show by feel different types of information, whether it be sort of a hard border, a land border, a sea border, potentially, you know, a town, a city, what is going to signify that? So it was really interesting to feel and see the ways in which that had been done. And yeah, but I mean, actually, it's a lot of fun. I mean, it's not a skill Jay and I possess, sadly. You know, I would challenge myself to do it more often, because it is, it feels like it's activating a part of your brain that I never am trying to, I'm never using almost, but something that I would love to be able to do, right? Because it would improve my mind's eye, which I always think actually in my case is quite weak anyway. And just by closing my eyes and trying to feel out what was, it turned out, Southern Europe, but I couldn't identify it. But like, I could feel my brain working so hard to try to do it. I was like, okay, so I can feel there's something there. And what can I marry that up with in my mind's eye that is, and I couldn't quite do it. But it's a great challenge, you know. And thank you for sending that through. It was really interesting.
Did notice that Sicily is missing from that particular page. That might just be a trap street.
They did say that the person who makes the maps said there's an awful lot left off, just keeping it very simple. But I did think, especially by reading the book as well, that every map leaves things off. Every map's a bit of a compromise because you simply can't put every detail on a map.
Yeah, well, no, you can't. You have to have map at a scale of 1 to 1 in order to do that. I think we say that in the introduction of the book, actually, which wouldn't be particularly useful because that would cover the entire world. I mean, that is just the world. So every map is a set of decisions and things to include and exclude. No map shows everything. So yeah, and I think that's what people often forget when they're using a map. It's that I think they think they're being presented with the world as it is, but actually maps are sort of they're representations of how somebody wants you to see the world.
Exactly. Every map, by definition, has to have some kind of distortion or omission. And, you know, even if it's a very basic map where every producer would end up with the same thing. So say a simple street map where all you show is where the streets are and what the names are. Well, even that's got an agenda because you could have a map of exactly the same area designed for birds. And that wouldn't have the names of streets. That would have what type of trees there are, how tall the trees are, how far apart they are, which way south is, which I suppose matters a lot more to birds, you know. And it makes you realize that every map, by definition, is false. Every map, by definition, contains some kind of lie in order to do its job. So famously, the map of the London Underground is not to scale. It just shows which stations appear in which order and where the interchanges are. But it stretches and squashes distances, you know, like nobody's business, in order to make it easier to understand. And every map does the same thing, just not in as obvious a way.
Much more from the Map Men in a moment.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
I'm Tibor Fisher, and this is my story, Listed for Trial.
This is Julian Barnes, and I'm reading a story I wrote called The Things You Know.
Hello, my name's Peter Robinson, and I write a series of books featuring DCI Alan Banks.
This is Doris Lessing, and I'm reading a chapter from my novel, The Sweetest Dream.
Hello, I'm Helena Bonham Carter, and I'm reading Sandy and Her Beautiful Sisters, A Modern Fairy Tale, by Antonia Fraser.
Here is the news by Richard Baker, read by the author.
I'm Bill Bryson, reading from my book One Summer, America, 1927.
Hello, this is Faye Weldon, and this is one of my stories. It's called Eyes in the Dark.
This morning I had my usual breakfast of toast and marmalade, which I have to have because that's Paddington's favourite.
This is Julia Donaldson, and you're listening to Talking Books.
My name is Jim Broadbent, and I'm delighted to be reading for Talking Books.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books library. So here are two new gems.
12 Ways to Kill Your Family at Christmas by Natasha Bash. Was given to us by HarperCollins.
Breathing to calm my nerves. I went over my affirmations. You are safe. You are loved. You have nothing to hide. Well, safe except for the fact I was being accused of committing the brutal murders of 10 of my family members in cold blood. Sure, there may have been times I daydreamed about sticking Tristan's nether rod in a chappy chopper, or flaying the twins alive while they cried for mercy. But how anyone could think I might actually have gone through with those things, I'll never know. Detective Chief Inspector Randolph clicked the button to begin the formal interview. I cleared my throat and attempted to swallow, my tongue unwieldy and coarse inside my mouth. Reaching for the glass of water, I failed miserably at keeping my hands from shaking. I kept my eyes fixed on the detective, determined to prove my innocence.
All Olivia wanted was one last miserable Christmas with her husband's awful family before moving to Australia. She didn't expect a murder. Now the snow has cut them off and she's stuck in a stately country house with her increasingly deranged relatives and the rising suspicion that someone is picking them off one by one. As the bodies pile up and the festive facade starts to crack, Olivia must survive the season, or at very least, get through lunch without anyone else choking on a sprout. Sharp, smart, and deliciously twisted, this is Christmas with all the trimmings. Cold cuts, warm lies, and at least one suspicious pudding.
This interview is being tape recorded and may be given in evidence if your case is brought to trial. We are in an interview room at Shrewsbury Police Station. The date is the 2nd of January 2026. The time by my watch is 2:34 p.m. I am Detective Chief Inspector Lakeith Randolph, and with me is Detective Sergeant Helen Birch. We will now continue with the interview.
I nodded, smiling enthusiastically so that Randolph and Birch could see how helpful and how very clearly innocent I was. But the mask was threatening to slip. 6 hours into this interview, and I was seriously beginning to flag. My mothy-smelling solicitor shifted in the seat next to me, readjusting his crotch. I wrung my fingers in my lap, desperate not to let my irritation show.
Go through with us again, if you will, your movements the morning of the 15th December 2025. Describe for me where you were and the members of the family were and what you were doing the morning that George Weiss fell from the roof.
I shifted in my seat. As I've said before, Detective Inspector, it was around 10 or 11 in the morning. I can't exactly remember. I had gotten up early that day. I like to get a swim in before 7, you see. Anyway, after I'd finished showering, I headed to the kitchen and had granola and a banana. Everyone else was still in bed. I racked my brains. Everything was such a muddle. So much had happened. So many deaths. I could hardly keep track of one day to the next. Which murder was he asking about again?
12 Ways to Kill Your Family at Christmas by Natasha Bash is narrated by Lucy Price-Lewis, Kristen Atherton and Joe Javison and runs for 9 hours and 45 minutes.
The Gingerbread Christmas Village by Kylie Dunbar was donated by Darling Kindersley.
There's so much about my childhood that I can't help but see through a happy rose-tinted haze. And it looks rosier the older I get. I happen to be 65, by the way, the same age as Madonna, which I enjoy telling people. What I'm trying to say is that when I was little, I knew I was one of the luckiest girls on earth. Not only were my parents madly in love, and not only did we live in the prettiest village in the Cotswolds, but I was fortunate enough to be born the eldest daughter of absolutely the best gingerbread baker in the Northern Hemisphere, possibly the universe.
The annual Wheaton Gingerbread Exhibit, a model village made of gingerbread, and grotto, has been an important part of the sleepy Cotswold hamlet's Christmas celebrations for decades. For years, the gingerbread exhibit drew visitors from across the region, and each year the model town grew more elaborate and ambitious. But recently, interest has been dwindling. The gingerbread grotto needs to be rehomed or closed forever. 64-year-old Margie, the event's founder, has had enough of village life and its total lack of eligible men, and is planning to sell up and head to Birmingham to live closer to her niece. She's lost her spark and her Christmas spirit, and decides that this will be her last gingerbread village, but despairs when she finds only support in her old friend Izzy, her niece Lucy from Birmingham, and Fern, the shy young farmer's daughter.
I can't attest to her Victoria sponges or her spotted dick or shortbread fingers. Mum had one recipe, and one recipe only, her gingerbread. And I'm not talking about a batch of biscuity men rustled up every now and again to satisfy my sweet tooth, either. That would be thinking far too small for Mum, who every December could be found working away at her cottage's kitchen table, spicing and kneading, rolling and cutting, cooling and icing, industriously assembling her famous gingerbread cottages. Attached to her mixing arm, you could bet your baubles there I'd be. Her gingerbread village's chief spoon licker. I can still see the scene now, as clear as day, that Christmas after Granny died, when Mum suddenly stopped in her stirring in our sugar-scented kitchen, glanced at my baby sister Lydia, asleep in her Moses basket, and announced with eyes both absent and urgent, "I should write it down for you quick, Margie." She snapped doughy fingers and sent me to fetch a felt tip.
The Gingerbread Christmas Village by Kylie Dunbar is narrated by Kerry Wotton and runs for 9 hours and 58 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
In today's, and indeed in last week's Read On, I'm chatting to Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones, the Map Men, about their book This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters. But I asked, what happens when the maps are taken away? Is it good for our mental health to be lost?
That was our starting point for the book. And that's what, you know, as I said at the beginning, we wanted to write this book about getting lost. And almost, I suppose the part of the motivation for writing this book is that that is, the art of getting lost is in itself a lost art, because of the way maps are able to guide us now, digital maps and GPS located services. And that's a good thing. You know, we are on board with that. It's very, very helpful in all sorts of ways. But you also have to acknowledge or recognize when a new technology like that has another side to it. And in this case, it's that we're not having to think about where we're going as much as we used to. And you know, it's early days for the research into the effects of that. But there are some suggestions that by not using the part of the brain responsible for orienting ourselves, which is called the hippocampus, and it's the same part of the brain which is responsible for memory. And there are suggestions from some of the research that our overdependence on using GPS could be increasing the likelihood of contracting Alzheimer's later in life. But I think the proof is still in the post a little bit. But there are some early warning signs. And so we are sort of encouraging people in a way to use different types of maps, or to even, dare I say, throw the map out altogether and just sort of explore a place for yourself and get lost and then hopefully get unlost again. But in doing so, you know, you have to activate that part of the brain. You have to think, you have to figure out where you are and try and find your own way.
I mean, if you're late for a meeting, then obviously use all the tools you have available. And, you know, even Mark and I, who love maps, you know, we use Google Maps just like everybody else. But if you've got a bit more time to spare, turn location services off, and getting lost might actually be the best part of your day, because when else are you going to get to experience things you wouldn't have experienced, or, you know, find things you didn't know were there, or talk to people and ask for directions, which you wouldn't otherwise do. So, we want to celebrate getting lost as a good, well, not just good, but important thing. Unless you're late for a meeting, in which case, no, use Google Maps.
Now, do either of you have a favourite fictional map?
Oh, do I have a favourite fictional map?
Sure. I mean, our book ended up being full of them, because it turns out there are more. All maps are technically fictional. I'm a big fan of the beginning of the Winnie the Pooh stories, the map drawn by E.H. Shepherd of the 100 Acre Wood. You know, that's probably the earliest example I can think of from childhood of a map that I was familiar with.
That is a nice one, isn't it?
Yeah, because it's, you know, it's not just got the locations where it says here's Pooh's house and here's the forest. And, you know, it's got these little illustrations, and it's a very good introduction into how maps work for a young child, I think.
I think for a lot of people, the answer there would be sort of the Lord of the Rings things. And I think it is really interesting the way those Tolkien maps at the start of the Lord of the Rings books fired a lot of people's imaginations for the books themselves. I think a lot of people found themselves constantly going, oh wow, it's really built a world here, and I go back to the beginning and look at it. And I definitely felt that when I read those. I think, you know, Jay and I both have young toddlery children at the moment, so I think Winnie the Pooh, yeah, lives large in the imagination in this household. So but along the same lines, I'm going to have to say the fact that my four-year-old is so into drawing treasure maps now, which is just absolute catnip to me. I'm gonna have to say he just loves putting absolutely rubbish detail all over them, and they're my favorite.
A Beer in the Loire by Tommy Barnes, narrated by Jay Foreman. Bert leered at me, squat, beer-bellied, surly, defiant, a cigar butt protruding from the corner of his chubby, English-hating face. He had stolen my wallet, but I had cut him off in the front garden before he could escape, and I was currently working out how hard I should hit him with a spade. There'll be apologists out there saying, violence doesn't solve anything, and you shouldn't take the law into your own hands, and he's only a 9-week-old puppy, don't hit him with a spade. But you weren't there, guys. You were not there.
Jay, can I ask you about A Beer in the Loire, your first ever audiobook narration?
Many years ago, I said yes to a job narrating an audiobook that I didn't write myself. And there's a remarkable coincidence. So I narrated that audiobook in what was then my home studio, which was the cupboard under the stairs. And I was sitting there reading the book, doing my job of narrating the audiobook. And I realized when I was about halfway through, I noticed that the guy whose book I was reading, he said that he lived in North Hertfordshire, and he mentioned his age and he mentioned where he worked. And I thought, I wonder if my brother-in-law knows this guy, because he's from the same area. And I said to him, I've been working on this audiobook. Have you heard of Tommy Barnes? And he says, Tommy Barnes? He's my best friend. He was at my wedding, and so were you. You've met him. Here, look, I've got a photo of him. And the thing that blew my mind, not only was it a mad coincidence that I was reading the... And, you know, he didn't know me. He contacted me through my agent. So it was a genuine coincidence that I was reading this guy's audiobook who I'd already met. But the absolutely mad thing was, for the first chapter of the book, I didn't realize it was a true story. I thought I was reading fiction. And I had in my mind this character. And it then, you know, gradually dawned on me, not only that he was real, but that I'd met him, which was really quite a bizarre coincidence.
I didn't know that.
And then it must have been even weirder for my brother-in-law, because he said he downloaded the audiobook and listened to it. And so he was listening to the story of his friend, but being read by his brother-in-law, which absolutely messed with his mind. And one other pretty terrible thing about that book is that it takes place in the French town of Braslu, which I mispronounced throughout the entire book as Braslu. And it's far too late to go back and change it now.
This was the culmination of a week of psychological warfare, and up until now, Bert had been winning comfortably, thanks to a couple of sensational coups. 2 days before, he had chewed open my cigar box and hidden the cigars around the garden, and today, he'd stolen my wallet from my back pocket while I was bending over to get him some food. He was a raving sociopath. Rose, my girlfriend, called me from the upstairs landing. Tommy, I think you should come and see this. Hold on, I'm going to hit Bert with a spade, I said. He's a 9-week-old puppy. People said that about Hitler. Nobody said that about Hitler. Leave him alone and come and see this. Okay, fine. I'm going to throw him as high as I can into a tree.
Now, Mark, we've talked about wrong maps, but I believe the most expensive map in the world is also wrong.
The most expensive map in the world is, well, all maps are wrong. That's the first point we make in our book, because all maps have to distort the world in some way. The most expensive map in the world is the very early 1500s, and it's by a man called Martin Waldseemüller. I think it's 1510. Is that right, Jay?
Shall I quickly Google it? I'm going to guess 1507, and if I'm right, I win a Haribo. Let's see. Martin Waldseemüller map America. The answer is 1507. Hooray!
Oh, no. That's a real blow. Jay has a much better memory than me. So Martin Waldseemüller, this is sort of shortly after the European discovery of the Americas. And Columbus, of course, quite famously never really believed, or certainly didn't admit, that he had found a new continent, choosing instead to believe that he had found the West Indies, China, Japan, and that part of the world. And as a result, a slightly later explorer called Amerigo Vespucci was able to claim that he had found a new continent. And a German world map-making cartographer called Martin Waldseemüller was the first to write America in very small letters on Brazil on his world map. And that is thought to be the first labelling of America in that way. And the American Library of Congress a few years ago purchased that map for $10 million, which makes that the most expensive map ever bought. And it's interesting because, you know, the irony is it doesn't say America anywhere near what we now call America. Obviously, it is in South America, but they were so keen to sort of own that part of that, you know, that nation-forming history, historic moment, that they were willing to pay top dollar.
What's happened since that map is that the word America on its own, most people in the English-speaking world think of the United States of America. And it's actually quite strange that that country just, you know, shotgunned the name America for itself when there's actually rather a lot of countries that are not happy about that decision. Because, you know, no one's ever come up with a better name for the United States of America because it's quite long and unwieldy. But someone from that country, the demonym is American. No one ever says United Statesian. Which
even
is,
though neither Vespucci, Amerigo Vespucci, nor Columbus ever visited the bit of land that we now call America, any US territory, they never set foot on it. So it's an interesting act of sort of, the reclaiming of a name by the USA, when really the Americas, what we call the Americas, South America and Central America, those probably have more claim to the word America than the United States of America.
And not going to a place that you've since mapped can result in some big anomalies like the mountains of Kong.
Yes, there was a famous Scottish explorer called Mungo Park, who was one of the first Europeans to visit that part of West Africa. And he was the first European to set eyes on the River Niger. And he came back from his travels and he'd written this diary with incredible detail about everywhere he'd been and everything he'd seen. And this diary then got translated into a map. There was a famous mapmaker called James Rennell. He was a big geographic expert, and he interpreted everything from the diary into something you could actually draw on a map. But he made one mistake. There was a bit where Mungo Park said, "I looked from the hill and I could see there was a large mountain where I thought I'd been before." So he then drew a mountain, and then he thought, well, this, I think, is the source of the River Niger. It must be a very long mountain range if what he said is true. So he drew more and more and more mountains on his map. He drew them in this absurd, geographically improbable single file, stretching all the way from the west coast of Africa to the east coast of Africa. And I'm pretty sure that when he did it that time, they were supposed to be a hypothetical mountain range. However, so trusted was his geographic expertise that another mapmaker then copied his map, copied the mountains of Kong, and all of a sudden they were on two maps, which means that there's no going back. They are now real. And those mountains, despite not existing, appeared on every European map of Africa for nearly 100 years. And it's incredible. It took until 1897 for someone to finally say, nearly 100 years later, nope, those mountains, the mountains of Kong, they are not there. They were never there. It's just a couple of very small lumps. But it betrays an extraordinary, flagrant disregard for the people that actually lived in Africa, that Europeans were drawing these maps, actually using, in one case, they were using the so-called Mountains of Kong as a border between two countries that they, you know, had demonstrably never visited.
There was a map I was trying to find. I saw it in the Tate Modern. It's a map that had a profound effect on me. It was basically the UK Ordnance Survey maps had been cut up and towns had been placed in the wrong place.
The concept is a familiar one, because if you take something that's familiar, like, you know, people, if they're familiar with the map of the UK, if you take it and cut it up and move things around, it makes you imagine it in a new way. And there's a way of doing this that comes up quite a lot, is you take a familiar map but put it upside down. So the text is all correct and you can read the words and you can see where everything is in relation to other places. But by making the map upside down, it sort of forces you to reimagine it, and it forces you to sort of notice things that you wouldn't have noticed the first time around if it was that familiar same way up as usual. There's a very famous map called, oh, I forgot what it's called, but it's 1979, MacArthur's
Universal Corrective.
That's the one. So on that map, everything is usual, everything is to scale, everything is correct. However, south is at the top. And what that means is New Zealand and Australia, which are normally tucked away in the bottom right corner, they are at the top and at the center. And it makes you realize just how big the distance between these countries are. And it makes you realize that poor New Zealand has to sit in the bottom corner of maps all the time. And it doesn't actually have to. It's just a convention that's followed by a mere vast majority of maps that New Zealand has to be in the bottom right corner. But if you put it at the top, Britain gets tucked away in the corner for a change.
I'd like to see that map, though, Rob. I mean, it sounds interesting. It sounds, you can imagine it as something that belongs in the Tate Modern, for example. I mean, because it has a similarity to, we talked about the Situationists earlier in the French, you know, 1960s, slightly surrealist movement. And one of their most famous map was called A Naked City Map of Paris. And that involved cutting up different bits of Paris, putting them in different parts, putting big red arrows. I'm not sure how similar this is to the Ordnance Survey thing, because I haven't seen it. But it was about challenging the way we see the map and challenging the way we people saw Paris. So possibly along similar lines.
Now, this show is going out just before Christmas. Are you familiar with the map that tracks Santa across his route around the world?
Very much so. And my 10-year-old nephew adores it. And every time I go around there on Christmas Eve, he is like, his eyes are glued to the Santa map and watching where he is. And what's wonderful is that that map, rather than sort of shaking his belief in Santa and making it so apparent just how many millions of toys he has to deliver in such a short time, it just makes Santa appear all the more magic. It makes him both more and less real at the same time, which is wonderful.
Fantastic. So if you're looking for a late Christmas gift, or indeed if you get a book token on the big day, I highly recommend This Way Up, When Maps Go Wrong and Why It Matters. Mark Cooper-Jones and Jay Foreman, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to you and to your listeners.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
Last week it was Mark Cooper-Jones, now with Books of My Life. This week, Jay Foreman. So Jay, is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading?
I love The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy because it was full of such absurd detail and sentences that just tumble over each other and go on for far too long. It's had even now, I haven't read it in years, but it's had such a profound influence on all the things that I write. And you know, it's the more I get comfortable with the fact that I suppose I am a geek all along, you know, then yeah, big, very, very soft spot for The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and all of the but dozens of sequels that came after as well.
Far out in the uncharted backwaters of the unfashionable end of the western spiral arm of the galaxy lies a small, unregarded yellow sun. Orbiting this at a distance of roughly 92 million miles is an utterly insignificant little blue-green planet whose ape-descended life forms are so amazingly primitive that they still think digital watches are a pretty neat idea. This planet has, or rather had, a problem, which was this. Most of the people living on it were unhappy for pretty much of the time. Many solutions were suggested for this problem, but most of these were largely concerned with the movements of small green pieces of paper, which is odd because on the whole it wasn't the small green pieces of paper that were unhappy. And so the problem remained. Lots of the people were mean, and most of them were miserable, even the ones with digital watches. Many were increasingly of the opinion that they'd all made a big mistake in coming down from the trees in the first place. And some said that even the trees had been a bad move, and that no one should ever have left the oceans. And then, one Thursday, nearly 2,000 years after one man had been nailed to a tree for saying how great it would be to be nice to people for a change, a girl, sitting on her own in a small cafe in Rickmansworth, suddenly realized what it was that had been going wrong all this time, and she finally knew how the world could be made a good and happy place. This time it was right, it would work, and no one would have to get nailed to anything. Sadly, however, before she could get to a phone to tell anyone about it, a terrible, stupid catastrophe occurred, and the idea was lost forever. This is not her story. But it is the story of that terrible, stupid catastrophe and some of its consequences. It is also the story of a book. A book called The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Not an Earth book, never published on Earth, and until the terrible catastrophe occurred, never seen or even heard of by any Earthman. Nevertheless, a wholly remarkable book. In fact, it was probably the most remarkable book ever to come out of the great publishing corporations of Ursa Minor, of which no Earthman had ever heard either. Not only is it a wholly remarkable book, it is also a highly successful one. More popular than the Celestial Home Care Omnibus? Better selling than 53 more things to do in zero gravity? And more controversial than Ulon Kolufid's trilogy of philosophical blockbusters, Where God Went Wrong, Some More of God's Greatest Mistakes, and Who Is This God Person Anyway? In many of the more relaxed civilizations on the outer eastern rim of the galaxy, The Hitchhiker's Guide has already supplanted the great Encyclopedia Galactica as the standard repository of all knowledge and wisdom. For though it has many omissions and contains much that is apocryphal, or at least wildly inaccurate, it scores over the older, more pedestrian work in two important respects. First, it is slightly cheaper. And secondly, it has the words, "Don't Panic," inscribed in large friendly letters on its cover. But the story of this terrible, stupid Thursday, the story of its extraordinary consequences, and the story of how these consequences are inextricably intertwined with this remarkable book, begins very simply. It begins with a house.
That's Gordon DeLeu reading from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams, one of the many books in the series available from RNIB. Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily go back to and reread?
You reminded me at the start of Limmy's Daft Wee Stories, and I absolutely love it because it's a book you can dip in and out of. You know, you don't have to read the whole thing in order, but, you know, it helps if you do because the stories get gradually funnier as it goes on. And he's got such a wonderful writing style. And of course, if you listen to the audiobook, you get to hear Brian himself performing it. So, yeah, big fan of Limmy's Daft Wee Stories.
That I made.
That you made, yes.
Upside Down. By the way, in the print version of the book, this story's printed upside down. I know it doesn't make much sense in audio, but they wanted it in, so there you go. Anyway, upside down. Well, would you look at this? Everything's upside down. No, it isn't a mistake. I asked the folk that make the books if they could do this sort of thing, and they said aye. I didn't really think I would go ahead with it, but here we are. I wonder what you look like right now, holding a book upside down. I wonder if anybody can see you. If you're reading this on some kind of e-reader thing, I don't think anybody will notice. But if this is an actual book, and somebody sees the cover upside down, they'll be wondering what the score is with you. If you're reading this in the house and somebody walks in on you, you'll look like you've been up to something, and you quickly grab the book when you heard footsteps. If they ask you what you're doing, you could show them the upside down page, but they might not ask. They might just come to their own conclusions and say nothing. That sort of thing makes people drift apart. Or maybe you're a guy reading this on a beach. A guy on the beach holding an upside down book. You'll look like a perv. If you're on a bus or a train, you might look suspicious, trying to appear to be normal. But you know, your book's upside down. Your mind's on other matters. A bomb, perhaps? Look around. Is anybody looking at you with suspicion? Oh dear, you looked around. Now you've gone and made yourself look all shifty. Anyway, I thought I'd try this out. Maybe get you into a spot of bother for a laugh. I hope you're no deed.
That's Brian Lemond, or Limmy, reading from his book Daft Wee Stories, available in audio from RNIB. Is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be contemporary, but you've read it recently, it's fresh in the mind, you'd like to recommend?
Yes, John Ellidge's book, History of the World in 47 Borders, is, you know, if you enjoyed our book and you've had your appetite for maps whetted, it was described, Richard Osman was very kind to mention our book on his podcast, and he mentioned this book as well, saying that it was the grown-up version of our book, and I will take that. So, yeah, if you if you enjoyed Matt Men's book, please also read John Ellidge's book, History of the World in 47 Borders, which, as I can attest myself, it works very well as an audiobook as well.
Yeah, I'm not sure about cross-promoting other cartographic books, but I have to say it is a good book. I've read it as well.
The transition from prehistory to history is not the point at which stuff started happening. It merely marks the point at which people started writing stuff down. As a result, it's impossible to say with any certainty where the first borders appeared, since the urge to divide us from them almost certainly predates the urge to chronicle it in a form that will survive to be read in the 21st century. Actually, the earliest city-states, tribes, or other peoples with some kind of group identity, delete according to ideology and taste, may have got away without borders in the modern sense simply because the world was, by modern standards, empty. They no doubt had the notion of where the land under their control came to an end, but beyond it, there was less likely to be a notional line marking the border with another tribe than a no-man's land controlled by no one. If anyone had invented maps, which they hadn't, they would have looked less like today's patchwork of nation-states than like space or the sea, islands of order in a sea of chaos. One of the first places where that ceased to be true was in northeastern Africa. In prehistoric times, this region had been home to nomadic hunter-gatherers who moved from place to place in search of food, possibly with herds of cattle in tow. Sometime around the 8th millennium BCE, though, natural climate change meant the land began to dry out, and over many generations, the nomads settled down to farm the reliably fertile lands beside the river. Those lands, though, were narrow compared to the great desert beyond. The settled lifestyle meant a lot of people in a relatively small space. So it is that, working chronologically, the first example of something resembling a modern international border you'll come across, sometime in the 4th millennium BCE, is almost certainly the one you'll find on the Nile. To the border's north lay Lower Egypt, the land of the Delta, a relatively wide, fertile area prone to flooding. To the south was the higher ground of Upper Egypt, the land of the valley, where the band of fertile land was narrower and all the settlements crowded hard by the river. The dividing line, if there was anything as coherent as a line, has traditionally been placed somewhere around the 30th parallel. These two kingdoms had different customs, dialects, and probably geopolitical interests too, with the north looking to the Mediterranean and the Levant, the south to Nubia and into Africa. There's no reason to imagine they saw themselves as two halves of one divided whole either. The idea of Egypt came later.
A history of the world in 47 borders. The stories behind the lines on our maps by John Elledge is available in the RNIB Talking Book Library as read by the author. Thanks once again to Jay Foreman and Mark Cooper-Jones. This Way Up is available from RNIB and from all good bookshops. That's all we've got time for on today's show. All that's left to say is Merry Christmas from the whole team at Read On, which is just me. I'll be back at the same time next week with part one of a review of 2025. Stay tuned as there's lots coming up next year, or if you want to catch up with Read On, every single episode to date is available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On in your favourite podcast app. And have a lovely Christmas and New Year.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.